Today's scripture reading comes from Genesis 11, 12, and 15. Now Sarah was childless because she was not able to conceive. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years, and he died in Haran. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you." So Abraham went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward." But Abram said, "Sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus?" And Abram said, "You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir." Then the word of the Lord came to him, "This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir." He took him outside and said, "Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. He also said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." But Abram said, "Sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it?" So the Lord said to him, "Bring me a heifer, a goat, and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon." Abraham brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. Then birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. As the sun was setting, Abraham fell into a deep, deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking firepot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land, from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites." This is the word of the Lord.
In a season of life when I needed a second family, Jerry and Misty provided that for me. They had only known me all of about 2 weeks when they invited me to stay in their home. I was 22. I had just moved to Baltimore to go to police academy, and they took me under their wing. They gave me hot meals. They provided a listening ear and a general sense of support during that season of being far away from home. Jerry would become sort of a mentor for me. He would mentor me, of course, in the way that Jesus mentored his disciples in a fishing boat on the water. We would often spend Tuesday mornings out on the lake. But I love being around Jerry and Misty because they were the kind of people, to borrow a phrase from a poem and a movie, that suck the marrow out of life. You know what I'm talking about? Live life to the full in every experience. I've only seen them a couple of times since moving away from Baltimore 13 years ago, but we've kept up through Facebook and email and the occasional phone call. Jerry's approaching 70, and so I wasn't surprised that a couple of weeks ago when I saw that he posted on Facebook that he was retiring at the end of September. I was taken aback, however, at what he posted next. You see, he wasn't retiring to do more fishing or to play golf or even to travel the world. Jerry's retiring after 47 years of working so that he and his wife Misty can follow what they sense to be God's call, leading them to the opposite side of the country to serve a refugee population. You hear that and you think, why on earth would you do that? I mean, you've achieved the American dream. You've worked all of your adult life. You've gotten to this point where it's time to kick back, enjoy the fruits of your labor. Why would you sell your house and leave the only part of the country that you've ever lived in to go do something so radical? And the reason is that Jerry and Misty have faith in something that's greater than the American dream, something that's greater than a comfortable retirement, something that's unshakable, something that produces confidence and joy and passion. Their story reminds me of another story, the story that Dave read for us this morning, the story of Abraham. You probably know that Abraham is a hero to three major world religions, the Christian faith, Judaism, and Islam. That's about 54% of the world's population, 4 billion people who look to Abraham as a founding father of their faith. Why is that? What was so unique about Abraham? What stands out as his defining characteristic? It was his bold faith. In fact, when a later writer described Abraham's life in the book of Hebrews, he said this: by faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Abraham's faith was built on his hope in something with foundations, something that he could not yet see. And you know, I think we all want to live that kind of life. The kind of life that's unshakable. We're so often held captive by the changing tides of circumstance. When things are going well, we believe in God and we're joyful, but then a circumstance changes and, oh, maybe not. I mean, heck, the weather changes. And look at the kind of week we've had. I've been depressed all week. It's been like Seattle here or London. It's been gray and cloudy and rainy. I think we long to have a life that doesn't waver with the circumstances, a life that taps into something greater, something lasting. I think that if you see what Abraham saw, you can have that kind of life. But you're going to have to see Abraham as more than just an example to follow. You're going to have to see his story in the context of the big story of the Bible so that you'll see how his story can be your story too. We're about 4 weeks into a sermon series that we've been calling The Big Story. We're walking through the Bible from start to finish over the course of a year, and we're trying to see how all the little stories are held together by one big story and see how they make sense of our story too. We started, in case you're just joining us, a few weeks ago by seeing in Genesis 1 that God created people as his most prized creation to enjoy a relationship with him and with one another and with the earth forever. We saw the next week in Genesis chapter 3 how the first human beings bought into a lie that said God is not for us, and they chose to act as if they knew better than God. They put themselves in His place, and as a result, they brought chaos and darkness and death and brokenness to every facet of human life. Because of that, we've all been born with this stain of sin, this inclination to believe that God is not for us, this propensity to place ourselves in God's seat. But more importantly, that week we saw the promise God made right there in Genesis 3, verse 15, that He would one day crush all evil and He would restore humanity. He would restore creation. He would restore all that we had broken. And God said that He was going to do that through one specific descendant or seed of Eve. Last week, Lou reminded us by looking at the story of the flood and how God rescued Noah's family, that God is still going about this plan, fulfilling His promise to restore what we've broken. Today, we're entering a new phase of the big story. We're calling it promises. This will take us through the next few weeks, where we see some of the foundational promises that God made that will drive the unfolding of the story. You'll want to have a Bible open, starting in Genesis chapter 12. If you're using the Pew Bible, you can find that on page 17. I believe your bulletin says that we'll be looking at chapters 12 and 13 today. It's actually chapters 12 and 15. We're going to cover a bit of ground. But we'll start in chapter 12, the first three verses. Lou left us last week at the end of the flood story in Genesis chapter 9. But if we were to read from the end of that through the end of chapter 11, where we're picking up today, we would see that in spite of God starting anew with creation, with Noah's family, really nothing much has changed. Because Noah and his children and their children are still infected with the stain of sin. It's gotten so bad along the way that people have built a powerful city, and they've tried to build a tower reaching all the way to the heaven, the ultimate expression saying, hey, we don't need God. We're okay on our own. God thwarted that effort. You know it as the Tower of Babel. And since then, what the writer of Genesis has been doing is taking us through the family tree of each of Noah's three sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth. And here, he's focused in on one line in particular, the line of Shem. And he's going to take us all the way down to one specific descendant of Noah, whose name is Abram. Now, throughout the morning, I'll go back and forth between Abram and Abraham. Don't be distracted by that. I'll explain why the name change in a few moments. But I think if we can understand what's happening in the broader context of the book of Genesis, what we'll see here is that the author wants us to keep in mind that initial promise from Genesis 3, God's promise to restore everything. And at this moment where we're dropping in, it seems that humanity's hopes of being restored rest in one family in Shem's line. The problem with that is, even that family has come to a dead end for two reasons. One reason is, we learn from some of the linguistic clues in chapter 11 and also from other references such as Joshua 24, that even the family of Abraham has gone over to worshiping idols. The one family that is supposed to be preserving the knowledge of the living God who created all the universe has given up. They're worshiping little gods, little statues, like all the other nations around them. And even if they hadn't, there's another reason that this family has come to a dead end, because Abram's wife, who's supposed to carry on this line of promise, can't have children. She can't conceive, Sarai. And so the hope for humanity has reached an absolute dead end. All hope is lost. Many of us, I think, know that feeling. We feel that we've messed up too bad, that there is no fixing our lives. There's nothing that God could do to redeem us, and we give up. It was that at a macro level here. There seems to be no hope for the world. And yet, even in that kind of situation, God intervenes. God speaks. He graciously takes the initiative. You see, Abraham wasn't qualified to play a great role in God's plan. He hasn't been living a great life of faith until God comes to him. He's an idol worshiper from all we know. And yet God calls him because God has made a promise that he's going to keep. Way back in the garden, the promise is to redeem people and to redeem creation, and God is not going to abandon that. And so he comes to this man named Abram, and he speaks to him. This is a foundational passage in Scripture, Genesis chapter 12. The promises we see here are going to drive so much of the rest of the story that we need to see what they are specifically. I'm going to put them on the screen here. One of the things that God promises to Abram in verse 2, he says, I will make you into a great nation. Even though your family has come to a dead end, you will one day become a great nation. God also says, I will make your name great. See, back in the Tower of Babel, people were trying to make a name for themselves. That's what we're told. And it didn't work. And God says, I'm going to give you a great name. And the very fact that we're sitting here talking about Abraham today shows us that that promise has come true. God also says, I will bless you, and I will bless those who bless you. And in fact, all peoples and nations on earth are going to be blessed through you. There's going to be flourishing. It's going to come to you and through you. In verse 7, God says, to your offspring, or your seed, there's that word again, I will give this land. It's the promise of a secure, prosperous homeland. What we lost in the garden. God's going to reiterate this over and over again. If we were to keep looking at the promises God makes, we would flip to chapter 17. You don't have to do that now, but God adds this. He ups the ante. He says, not only are you going to become a great nation, Abraham, you're going to become the father of many nations. And it's at that point that God changes his name. See, the name Abram meant great father, or we might say big daddy. I like that a little bit better. Abram was the big daddy. But God says, you're going to become the father of many nations, and so he gives him the name Abraham, which means father of many. Father of many nations. And then God adds this, I will be your God and the God of your descendants. In other words, you're going to have a special relationship with me, special access for you and your family. And then in chapter 22, finally, God adds this. He says, through your offspring or your seed, all nations on earth will be blessed. Do you realize what's happening here? This should be ringing a little bit of a bell in your mind if you heard Genesis 3 a few weeks ago. Because what God's promising here is that he's going to restore humanity's relationship with himself and with one another and with the earth. And he's going to do it through one specific family. In fact, he's going to do it through one particular descendant of Abraham who would bless people of all nations. God is saying, I have not abandoned my promise to make things right. He's still carrying out his redemptive work, and now he reveals this new facet that he's going to do it through this specific family. But God says, listen up, Abraham, because for this to work, you're going to have to do something radical. You're going to have to leave your homeland, leave your father's family, and go to the place that I'll show you. You know what's interesting, if you read through all of Abraham's story, is that on multiple occasions, God asks Abraham to do something pretty radical. And every time, he leaves something in the dark. He leaves some great unknown. Abraham says, okay, Lord, I'll go. Where are we going? God says, oh, don't worry about that. I'll show you when you get there. You're not going to have a detailed map. Later, it happens with Isaac. Take and sacrifice your son Isaac. Whoa, that is crazy. How's that going to work out? I'll show you. You see, Abraham became known for a bold faith because without having all the answers, he said an unconditional yes to God. And so many of us, when we sense that God is calling us for the first time to put our faith in him, to commit to him, or later in our lives to follow him into something unknown, we want to know the answers. We want to know how it works out. We want to know that we're going to be safe and comfortable and provided for. God, if I put my trust in you, you're not going to call me to give up this relationship, are you? You're not ever going to make me go there to those people, are you? You're not going to make me give up this habit, right? We want to know all the answers, and the reality is, if we insist on having every blank filled in before we commit ourselves entirely to God, we're never going to have the kind of life that we long for and that he longs to give us. It requires an unconditional yes to him. God called Abram to give up every source of security he had and follow him, and that's what he calls us to as well, to offer up everything that makes us feel secure and comfortable and put our trust entirely in him. So Abraham leaves everything that he knows. He takes his wife and his nephew and he goes, believing God's promises. And then something happens in chapter 15 that is really strange. But if we understand it, it is really beautiful. God does something in the beginning of chapter 15 that, as far as we can tell, hasn't yet happened since the Garden of Eden. And that is that he appears to Abram in a vision. And he says, do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward. You see, at this point, Abram could be going, I have left everything I know, and here I am with nothing. I have no business opportunities. I have no extended family. What am I doing? And God steps in and he says, don't worry about the fact that you have left every source of security because I will be your shield. Don't worry about the fact that you have left all of your business opportunities because I myself will be your very great reward. And if you read the intervening details of the story, you'll see that God blesses Abraham with uncanny opportunities in the next few chapters. I would encourage you to read those. And I think that God would probably say to you a similar thing today. If you're contemplating whether he can be trusted, whether it's okay to offer up your sources of security, he would say to you, I will be your shield and your very great reward. You don't have to know how it's all going to work out. But then Abram has this realization. And it's a realization that threatens to derail the whole plan. You know what it was? All those promises that God had made to Abraham hinged on one. One promise had to come true or else the whole thing fell apart. And Abraham realizes this. It was the promise of a son. You see, if Abraham didn't have a son, he wouldn't have descendants. He wouldn't become a great nation. They wouldn't inhabit a prosperous homeland. He wouldn't be able to bless people of every nation. It would be a dead end right there. He's got to have a son. And the problem is, his wife is pretty old and barren. Now realize how bleak of a situation this was for Abram. Some of you know, sadly, what it's like to want badly to have children and not be able to, and your pain is very real. But as great as your pain is, in Abraham's day, it was far worse. Because not only did you have the internal pain of childlessness, you also had social disaster. You had financial disaster in ways that are hard for us to understand in our day. It was absolute God-forsakenness to not be able to have children. And Abram is starting to feel like this might be a cruel trick. God, you called me to leave everything. You promised you're going to restore everything through my family. And hey, I don't have a family. I don't have any kids. And so in verse 3 of chapter 15, Abraham says, you know, Lord, I've been thinking, you haven't given me any children. What are we going to do about that? You know, Sarah, she's pretty old, way past age to be able to have kids. Maybe I should take things into my own hands and make him my heir. That's how we'll do it. I'll adopt him into my family, and that's how you'll fulfill your promises. We don't have time to go into all the details, but if we read the next few chapters, Abraham is going to try to take things into his own hands on multiple occasions in some pretty drastic ways. One of them, you may know, he listens to his wife's advice to spend the night with his servant girl, Hagar, in hopes of having a son through her. He does, and that creates all kinds of headaches for him and his family and the rest of the world since, right? Because it looks humanly impossible. How am I going to have a child? Let me figure this out on my own. At this point in time, God steps in verses 4 and 5, and he says, Abram, don't worry. I'm going to give you a son through your own flesh and blood. It seems impossible, but I'm going to do it. And in this moment, everything hinges on whether Abraham believes this one promise, the promise of a son, through whom the whole plan of restoration is going to be carried out. And then in verse 6 of chapter 15, we see one of the most important sentences in the entire Bible. Look there with me. Verse 6. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Abraham said, God, I don't know how this is going to happen, but I believe you at your word. And we know that Abraham did not have great character at this point in time. Abram was not this unwavering man of faith yet. He was still a very flawed individual. And yet God said, because you believe my promise, I will give you credit for complete righteousness. Now, some of you need to stop and just chew on that for a minute. That should really make you feel better because you think, you know, I've had my moments where I've believed in God. I've had a pretty good faith, but let me tell you, I can waver. I can fail pretty bad. What's going to happen then? And God says, my favor doesn't depend on how well you perform. I credit righteousness to you because of your faith. And we'll come back to that in a few minutes. So Abraham says, well, you know, God, what if you don't come through? What if I don't have a child? And God answers that. And then in verse 8, Abraham has another question. He says, okay, but what if I can't take possession of the land that you've promised to me? What if I'm not strong enough? What if I fail? What's going to happen to your promises then? You know, Abraham's questions were not all that different from our own. All right, God, so you're asking me to trust you, to step into the unknown? What if you don't come through? What if I fail? What if I can't do my part? What if I can't be faithful to you in the future? You know, Abraham lived most of his life in the gap between promise and reality. He did not see most of the promises be fulfilled. And that produces some real questions, doesn't it? We live in a similar gap between promise and reality. And these are questions that come about. What if God doesn't come through? What if I fail? But you know what? God is gracious to answer those questions. He doesn't say, Abraham, how dare you ask? He answers Abraham's questions in a very vivid way, in a scene that is probably one of the strangest scenes in the entire Old Testament, but one of the most beautiful pictures of the big story of God that we'll ever see. What happens is that God tells Abraham to bring him a few animals. And he doesn't tell Abram what to do with them, but Abraham knows because he can tell what's about to happen. You see, this is a custom that was very familiar in Abraham's day and time. It's very strange to us. But what was happening is that God was getting ready to ratify his covenant, his binding agreement with Abraham. And he was going to have him act out this picture of how committed he was to this covenant. See, we live in a day of written contracts. If we want to go into a binding agreement with someone, we have a lawyer draw up a contract and everybody signs it and it spells out the penalty of breaking the agreement, right? We've been replacing our windows at the house over the last few years. It's a long project. We're doing it in three phases because the house has lots of big windows. It's an old house. And every time it's time to begin again, the contractor makes us put down a pretty significant deposit so he can buy the materials, right? And when we give him the money, there's a place where we both sign that promises he's not going to take the money and run. He's actually going to bring the windows and install them. And it spells out, if he does take the money and run, what the penalties are, right? Written contracts. In Abraham's day, it was not so much a written culture. If you wanted to make a binding agreement with someone, you acted out the picture of accountability, the terms of the covenant. What would happen if you didn't keep your word? And so when God tells Abraham, go get some animals, Abraham knows what's happening. This was common, especially between powerful kings of large nations and vassal kings or kings that they conquered or that they were making an agreement with. And what would happen is that they would prepare animals, they would cut them in two. Seems really strange to us, but they would spread them in two halves so that there was a walkway down the middle of them. And then they would walk between the pieces of the animals. And they would spell out the terms of the covenant. So the stronger king would say, I'm promising to give you military protection. I'm promising to give you infrastructure. The vassal king would say, I'm promising that we will send you our taxes, that we'll send you manual laborers for all of your projects, and so on. And then they would walk between the pieces, in essence saying, if I fail to keep my word, let this happen to me. These animals that are cut in two, let it be so to me. I will be cut off from the land of the living if I don't keep my covenant with you. And so when God says to go get animals, Abraham knows that that's what's about to happen. He prepares the animals. He cuts them in half. He lines them up in a row. So far, it's playing out along with the cultural custom of the day. But then something shocking happens, something that was out of the norm. Abraham fell into a deep sleep. Now, why is that so strange? Well, he can't walk through the pieces if he's asleep. He's supposed to walk through and, you know, promise that he's going to stay faithful. But God puts him into a deep sleep. And then something else happens. This dreadful darkness falls over the whole area, the writer tells us. It much more than just a normal sunset. The dreadful darkness of places like the top of Mount Sinai, places like the cross. Something serious is happening here. And then God speaks. And what happens when God speaks is that he reiterates his promises to Abraham. He speaks his covenant. And then the most shocking thing of all happens, if you look at verse 17. A smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. What on earth is that? A smoking fire pot with a blazing torch. You know what that is? That's a theophany. That's a fancy word that means it's the physical manifestation of God's presence. The living God who has never been seen manifests himself in this form of a blazing fire pot, a torch. You know where else we see this? This shows up in the wilderness when God is leading his people out of Egypt. You remember how he leads them? Fire by night, a pillar of cloud by day. Same thing as this, same words. The very glory presence of God. This shows up on Mount Sinai when God gives his covenant and his glorious presence is so heavy that people can't even approach the mountain. Same thing. This is the very presence of God walking between these pieces of cut animals. Why is this so strange? What's happening here? Well, this is strange because in most settings where this ritual would play out in that day, the stronger king wouldn't pass between the pieces. That's not how human power structures work, is it? If you're in the seat of power, no way you're going to make yourself that vulnerable. You're going to make the weaker guy go through. Sure, that's normal. Maybe on occasion there was a time when the more powerful king would walk between the pieces if he was especially nice, but no, not the norm. Who is it that walks between the pieces here? It's the God of all the universe, the all-powerful, immortal God. He's saying, I am so committed to my promises to you, Abraham, and all of humanity, that if I fail to keep them, let this happen to me. Let me be cut off. But did you notice what else is really strange about this? He never makes Abraham walk between the pieces. Abraham is the one who's supposed to. He's supposed to say, let me be cut off if I can't be faithful to our covenant. And God doesn't make him pass through. You know what that's saying? God is saying, not only will I keep my promises to you, I am so committed to restoring all of humanity that if you fail to keep your end of the deal, let the curse fall on me. Let me be cut off from the land of the living. Do you see how this foreshadows everything else that's going to play out in the big story of the Bible? God is saying, I am so committed to you. Not only can you trust me to keep my promises, let me be torn in two if you fail to keep yours. That's going to drive the entire Old Testament, all the story as Abraham gives birth to Isaac, and Isaac has a family, and God continues to pour out his favor on that family, and they continue to walk away from him, and God continues to pursue them, all the way to the point that we get down to the birth of Jesus. God himself comes in the flesh to say, I am so committed to blessing you, to restoring you, that I'll even go to this length. Jesus lives the only perfectly faithful life, the only perfectly righteous life. And he goes to a cross where he hangs in utter God-forsakenness. And the gospel writers tell us again that the dreadful darkness fell over the whole land. Right? Should be putting two together. The picture's coming full circle here. And Jesus is torn for us. The penalty for our inability to be faithful falls on him. He's cut off from the land of the living. You see, God was so committed to redeeming you and redeeming me and restoring all of creation that he even took the curse on himself. He did it so that his righteousness could be credited to you through faith. That's the good news. That's the gospel. And it shows up all throughout the big story. It shows up right here in Genesis 15. I love the children's storybook Bible that we've been talking about, but the subtitle is wonderful. It's called Every Story Whispers His Name. Do you see how this story, this strange story, whispers the name of Jesus? The big story of the Bible is the fleshing out of these promises to Abraham, as depicted in the ritual with the animals, culminating in the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And your story will only make sense, and it will only be a story of confidence and conviction and foundations when your story is found in his story. Do you remember how I said before that everything hinged on whether Abraham would believe one promise, the promise of a son, that was the key to accessing all the other promises of God? He did believe in that promise of a son, and God credited him with righteousness. And sometimes people say, what about all the people who lived before Jesus? All the people in the Old Testament, can they be saved? They lived before Jesus. Well, the answer is right here. It wasn't through keeping the works of the law. It was through trusting in the promised son of Abraham. And the answer for you and me is the same. Access to God's promises doesn't come through works of the law. It comes through trusting in the promised son. Not Isaac, but Jesus, the greater son. That's what Paul says. He comes full circle in Galatians 3, thousands of years later. And he says, the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Scripture does not say, and to seeds, meaning many people, but and to your seed, meaning one person who is Christ. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. You are heirs of everything that God promised to Abraham through faith in God's Son. The promise of a restored relationship with God, special access to Him, restored relationships with other people, one day a restored creation. Right now, a kind of confidence, a foundation that gives you the kind of life that Abraham lived, they can all be yours through faith in the promised Son, Jesus, who proved how committed God is to you. I heard a story about an older man who had spent much of his adult life amassing a collection of famous works of art. He practically had a museum in his home. And this older man also had one son along the way. The son had joined the military and had gone away to war as a young man. There was a fierce battle, and he had a friend who was wounded, and in the process of trying to save that friend, the son was killed. But the friend managed to survive, and he felt so indebted to this son that the way he expressed his gratitude was to paint a portrait of that young man who had saved him. And he gave that portrait to the father as a way of expressing his thanks for his sacrifice. That portrait of the man's son became his most beloved work of art. He hung it in the living room. He saw it every day. Well, when the old man died, there was going to be an auction to auction off all of his famous works of art. People who knew about art were eagerly anticipating this. They'd been waiting for this day, and so they came in great numbers. And when they showed up, the auctioneer was standing there on the platform, and he had next to him an easel with a portrait of the son sitting on it, that portrait that had hung in the man's living room. And he said, "We're going to begin the auction today by auctioning off this portrait of the son." And people said, "We didn't come for that. Come on, let's get to the real works of art." And the auctioneer said, "No, we'll start with this one. Do I hear any bids? $100, $200, anybody?" People said, "No, we don't want that. Let's get to the real masterpieces." And it went on like that for a while. Well, eventually, a voice came from the back corner saying, I'll bid $10. It was the gardener who had taken care of the man's property for all those years, and he loved the son, and so he figured as a way of honoring him, he would buy it. So he said $10, and the auctioneer said, "I hear $10, so we have $20. And of course, there was silence. And he said, $10, going once, going twice, sold. And people breathed a sigh of relief. They said, "Okay, now we can get on with the show." But the auctioneer laid down the gavel, and he said, "I'm sorry, that concludes the auction." And he said, "Come on, what are you talking about? We've got all the famous pieces still." And the auctioneer said, "No, that there was a stipulation in the man's will that said that whoever takes the son gets the whole estate." See, God is totally committed to blessing you and to restoring you. He has made that promise. And he showed how committed he is to that by giving his son for you. And all that he wants to give you and all that he wants to bless you with can be yours through faith in the son. The one who takes the son gets everything. In a moment, we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. And I want you to see how this fits into the big story. What we're going to do is we're going to hold little pieces of broken bread in our hands, and they're going to remind us of how Jesus said, "This is my body broken for you." It was the picture of what Abraham saw all those years ago when God said, "I will take the curse on myself for you." Jesus would take a cup and say, "This is the new covenant in my blood." In other words, this is not a covenant that depends on your works. It's a covenant that depends on what I am doing right now for you. And anytime you eat this bread or you drink this cup, it's like walking between the pieces, like acting out the ritual again. The only difference is, you're not the one going through the pieces. I am. See, all the things that we trust in, all the things that we put our emotional hopes in, are going to make us go through the pieces eventually. Our looks, our job performance, our financial resources, all depend on what we can do and how we can come through. Human relationships, they're all going to make us walk through the pieces, not Jesus. He said, "I am going through it for you." And we'll take this today in remembrance of Him. Let's spend a moment of prayer. Father, in our honest moments, we see our frailty and our fickleness, how much we waver, how inclined we are to walk away from you and trust in ourselves. And it is impossible to fathom that you would love us so much to send your Son and be forsaken for us. I pray today, Lord, as we think about this story and as we hold these broken pieces of bread in our hands, that you would enable our hearts to believe the greatness of your love, so that we can have confidence walking into the unknown. Give us this by the work of your Spirit, Lord. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.